Over the past 2 weeks, Peoria-based Caterpillar has made headlines for a raid by federal investigators at three of its facilities and a report commissioned by the governor that accuses the company of tax and accounting fraud.
The report has a kind of very detailed, complicated analysis and then asserts that they committed tax fraud, which is not the typical thing you see.
Today we ask, what, if anything, does all this mean for Caterpillar's reputation? Plus, Ignatian spiritual leader Becky Eldridge tells us what a 500-year-old spiritual exercise means to her today.
Taking the last 24 hours of your life and bringing it before God is just as beautiful and profound of a prayer as sitting for an hour in silence.
We'll also get the latest in Illinois politics, but first, John Gross has been fired as head coach of the Illini men's basketball team. We'll talk with a News Gazette reporter about what this means for the program. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. That's all coming up on the 21st, after this news. The field for the NCAA men's basketball tournament was announced last night, and for the fourth straight season, the University of Illinois is not a part of it. That's one reason John Gross was fired as head coach of the Illini men's basketball program on Saturday after five seasons at the helm. He compiled a record of 95-75 overall, but only led the team to one NCAA tournament appearance during that time. On the line to discuss the move with us is Scott Ritchie. He covers Illini hoops for the News Gazette in Champaign. Scott, thanks for joining us after a busy weekend.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brian.
You're welcome. Athletic Director Josh Whitman made this decision official on Saturday. He had a news conference at Memorial Stadium to announce it. What reasons did he give for the change?
I mean, I guess the main reason, he kind of mentioned, he was in Champaign 10 years ago, kind of for that peak of Illinois basketball. And, looking back on it, it's 10 years now. He didn't want that to be 30 years ago, as the best moment for the Illini basketball program. So it was just a move he felt he had to make to get Illinois back to the level where it was competing for Big Ten titles, maybe even a national championship. So I think wins and losses certainly played a role in that.
Sure. Now, Scott, you've been covering the program for a few years now. Why wasn't Coach Gross able to have more success here at Illinois?
I think the main thing is, if successful basketball teams have successful basketball players, and John Gross had several recruiting misses and was the runner-up for a lot of players that could have helped the program, particularly when it comes to point guards. I mean, you kind of look at Quentin Snyder at Louisville, or Jalen Brunson at Villanova, Juwan Evans at Oklahoma State, who might be a first-round pick this year as a sophomore, and Illinois either had a commitment in the case of Snyder, who then decommitted at the last minute, or finished second for Brunson and Evans. And those guys could have led to more wins. And it's kind of a weird juxtaposition with maybe, with the best recruiting class in 5 years coming in the next season, when the program had been down for four straight years. So the recruiting wins came, it just wasn't soon enough to save John Gross, apparently.
Sure. In the short term, Scott, the team starts play in the NIT tomorrow night against Valparaiso. Who's in charge of the team right now, and how far do you think they can advance in this tournament?
Jamal Walker was elevated to interim head coach, so he'll be leading the way this week in the NIT. It's an interesting question about how far Illinois could go. I mean, the last time they made the NIT was in 2015, and the path there this season has mirrored the one from that year. Lost regular season finale, lost to Michigan in the first game of the Big Ten tournament, and then in 2015 it was a rout at Alabama and an early exit. Valparaiso doesn't have its best player there. And Alec Peters, who's out with a foot injury, they're not playing their best either. So it's a winnable game for sure. And then it'd be either Utah or Boise State in the second round, and neither of those is unbeatable. I think everyone maybe is sort of looking even further ahead to a possible Illinois-ISU matchup, which would certainly be interesting.
and that would take place in Normal next Tuesday if both teams advance. Longer term, Scott, what did Josh Whitman have to say about the search for a new coach? He certainly was able to pull off a bit of a stunner by hiring Lovie Smith to coach the football program last year.
I think the first thing that stuck out to me was Josh Whitman said that this search process wouldn't be like football, where he fired Bill Cubitt on a Saturday and then announced Lovie Smith as a new coach on a Monday. And so far, at 11:10 a.m. on this Monday, there's no new coach being named. So I'm kind of going minute by minute at this point, just being ready, you know, for that. But I think it might kind of take some time, a little bit of time. He doesn't want the job to be open that long. That's kind of his preference for any head coach position. But just for the NCAA tournament to play out a little bit, you know, there's still some pretty good coaches leading teams right now, coaches that are basically on everybody's wish list when a job comes open, and Greg Marshall and Archie Miller and the like. So I think it'll happen sooner than later in Josh Whitman's preference, but maybe not quite as soon as the 48-hour turnaround for football.
All right, and Greg Marshall, of course, the coach for Wichita State, Archie Miller, the head coach at Dayton. Well, Scott Ritchie, beat writer for the News Gazette for the Illini men's basketball program, thanks a lot for joining us today on the show.
Yep, thanks, Brian.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. It's been about a week and a half since federal investigators executed a search warrant at three Caterpillar facilities, including its Peoria headquarters. Then last week, a report commissioned by the government accused the Peoria-based company of an elaborate strategy of avoiding taxes and committing fraud involving nearly $8 billion and one of its Swiss subsidiaries. Caterpillar has denied breaking any federal tax laws. Last week, we spoke with the New York Times reporter who broke that story about the tax fraud accusation. Charges have not yet been filed, and it's not clear if they will be. Today we ask, what, if anything, does all this mean for Caterpillar's reputation? I'm joined now by two guests, Ron Culp, veteran corporate communications consultant and instructor at DePaul University in Chicago, and Harlan Loeb, the global chair of the public relations firm Edelman's Crisis and Reputation Practice in Chicago. Ron and Harlan, welcome to The 21st. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you so much.
Harlan, we're all waiting to hear what the outcome of this investigation will be, but I wanted to ask you, what might we expect the long-term impact of a federal investigation like this could be on Caterpillar's reputation?
Caterpillar's been around for quite some time and has been and continues to be an iconic brand. So while there obviously is reputation impact on any company that is involved in essentially the media's litigating of a fairly high-profile event, I don't think over the long term the reputational impact will be that significant. I think the question is what's best practice in the short term as they go through this, and it peaks and valleys a little bit in the media and in other circles. So I do think over time that they'll be fine. It's just a matter of how do you take something that really doesn't go to the core competency of the company? They're not in the business of, they're not an accounting firm. This isn't a referendum on whether and to what extent they're good at what they do. It really is a legal issue that will be resolved probably in the next 12 to 18 months. But it does keep them in the news in a way in which they're certainly not happy about.
Sure. And Ron, speaking of the short term that Harlan referred to there, how has Caterpillar's share price been affected by the raid a week and a half ago and the report this past week that accuses the company of tax fraud?
Well, I believe the stock price took a slight hit, maybe 1.5%, not even that, since the news broke last week. But when you look at the overall stock price, it's still up 28% over the past year. And I think today it's up slightly in a slight down market. So there's been a little effect. Many analysts suggest that the accounting issue is already baked into the price.
Sure. And Ron, what should we be listening for here that would be indications that the company could be in some trouble here?
Well, I think that the key factor that the company has to be concerned about, back to a point that that Harlan made, is long-term reputation can be affected. The more people hear something about an organization, especially an iconic brand like Caterpillar that's been around for some 90 years, established a really rock-solid brand. And they really will, after a time, say, what is the ultimate effect? Well, if it's a $2.5 billion or whatever the tax issue liability might be, you know, that's worth taking some risk with your brand. Fortunately, in this case, being a business-to-business corporation, Caterpillar isn't as susceptible as some consumer brands that are more easily targeted and get the reaction of the consumer, such as Uber and some of the other brands that people will lash out against, and they can make a statement. You know, we're talking about somebody selling large equipment and electric systems to major corporations. If the product works and no one is injured from your product, you know, I'm going to make the decision to continue buying this product. So I think little long-term effect. It's still just like everything else in heavy equipment and other manufacturers such as this. It's very much tied to the economy.
Sure. We want to note that we've reached out to Caterpillar to ask if they have a response to the report that accuses the company of tax and accounting fraud. They responded with the following statement. Caterpillar takes very seriously its obligation to follow tax law and pay what it owes. The IRS has challenged Caterpillar's taxes for the years 2007 through 2012. We disagree with the IRS's position, have cooperated for requests for information, and believe that we are compliant with tax laws and stand by our financial reporting. They went on to say that they just received a copy of the report last Thursday and are currently reviewing it. They declined our request for an interview. Harlan, back to you. Would you say that it is surprising or not that they're not speaking with the media right now?
Whether they're not, I'm sorry, I missed the last part of your question.
Is it surprising that they're not speaking with the media right now?
No. Right now, they don't want to, and I would advise them to do the same, not want to refrain from litigating this in the court of public opinion. I do think, though, that it puts the burden on any company, and this is not unique to Caterpillar in any way, to move with dispatch to resolve the issue. And if, in fact, there is a bona fide difference of legal opinion on the propriety of the tax, you know, their tax strategy and the counsel they've been given on the tax strategy, sooner rather than later, there needs to be some discussion of that so that, without litigating it, but some fairly binary discussion. Here's our position to the extent that legal counsel let them disclose. Here's what it is. Here's what it's based on. And particularly for as you asked, Ron, for the investor community, they want to continue to be able to solidly believe that this whole issue is baked into the price, which for a while I think we can all assume that to be true. But the more this lingers and the more its opinion trades as fact in the court of public opinion, the harder it gets for any company, for the reasons that you said, because there's a salience issue that when people hear the brand name, and as the longer this goes, the more likely it is that they'll associate the brand with the issue that's lingering.
Sure.
The tax issue.
And Harlan, when companies find themselves in the middle of an investigation like this, what can they do to help maintain a good reputation throughout the process?
Being as transparent as they possibly can, making sure, and we hear, of course, what they say to the media, but they need to be doubling down on their customer promise and their key relationships and making sure that those that matter most, their employees included, feel strongly and solidly that the company is on solid ground, that they're pursuing this with propriety and integrity, that they are keenly guided by the interests of those that allow them to be profitable, their customers, their employees, their shareholders, and so forth, so that the stakeholders that really give them the license to be profitable and license to be the iconic brand we talked about at the outset, that those interest holders feel comfortable that they're on solid ground.
And Ron, back to you. You've said that you suspect the government intentionally did this to attract some publicity to the issue of tax fraud, given that tax season is just around the corner. Does something like this happen typically each year around tax time?
It is surprising how often some issue reminding taxpayers that they have an obligation to pay their full share of taxes occurs. Is it actually orchestrated? I don't think that anyone could ever track that to anyone within government, but there seems to be a coincidence that just about the time everyone's filling out their taxes, there's always a story like this that erupts.
Sure. And Harlan, you agree with that assessment?
Yeah. There's a certain, as this case itself has noted, the media has noted, there is always an up and down on any number of different tax issues, and whether it's a large company's not paying state income tax, or there seems to be kind of a itinerant cadence to stories like this and or events like this that I think is a shot across the bow. And I'm not judging the mandate or the propriety, but a shot across the bow by regulators to send a signal to the broader marketplace that they're doing their job and keeping an eye on the flotilla here.
Very good. We'll have to leave it right there. Harlan Loeb, Global Chair of Public Relations Firms Edelman's Crisis and Reputation Practice in Chicago. Ron Cope, Veteran Corporate Communications Consultant and Instructor at DePaul University. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear Nyla Boodoo talk with Becky Eldridge, who's just published a new book about the 500-year-old spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ignatius of Loyola founded the Jesuit order in the 16th century. 500 years later, as a teenager in Baton Rouge, Becky Eldridge found herself having a spiritual awakening. Decades later for her, as a working professional and a busy mom, she still finds herself incorporating that meditative practice Ignatius created as a daily spiritual exercise. How others can also do that is outlined in a new book she just wrote. It's called Busy Lives, Restless Souls. It was published a few weeks ago on Ash Wednesday. Becky is in Chicago for a talk this evening, focusing on how Ignatian spirituality can be part of our everyday life year-round. And I spoke with her earlier from her home in Baton Rouge. Hi, Becky. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks so much for having me.
So you write in your book that Ignatius had the foresight to know that the interior life has to be adapted to fit the circumstances of our exterior lives. And I was wondering, what is it about a spiritual discipline that was created 500 years ago that still has resonance today?
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about it, was that it was created 500 years ago, and there's this legacy to it. And I think the big thing for me that I find personally that it still resonates. And then when I watch, just in my ministry work with other people, as I teach them about Ignatian spirituality, is just that idea of being a contemplative in action, and meaning that we can go about and live our lives in the world and have the many various hats that we wear and the many responsibilities we have, but we can still pause and make time for daily prayer, and how that prayer time with God impacts the rest of everything. And I think Ignatius figured out, he was such a saint, and a man at the time. He wasn't a saint at the time, but he was living just out in the world, and he wasn't cloistered in a monastery or tucked away as a hermit. He was living and preaching and everything out in the world, and that's still what we're doing today. And his wisdom can still be applied and speak to us in 2017.
And I guess my first question to you about that is, why do you think it's so hard for people to take time out of their day to stop and make time for prayer or meditation or to think about things? Do you think it's just not something we think about on a daily basis?
I think we're hungry for it, right? I think we all want to be able to do it. And right now our lives, I think, are just so full and they're so busy. And there's so many gifts of technology and the connectedness that we have online. And, you know, it really can connect us in a more global sense and stuff. But I find the kind of other side of that is it's really hard to disconnect and it's hard to put work down sometimes, you know, or it's hard. I'm a mom of three kids and, you know, the teachers might be emailing us, you know, and at 9 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, and you'll get something, a reminder about a project or, you know, a crazy day at school that's coming up and they need such and such socks or whatever. So I think the thing is there's always this information that's coming to us and it makes it challenging to give yourself permission to pause. I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is, I think because our lives are so busy and they're so full and we have so much going on that when we do stop, sometimes we can be afraid of what we're going to find when we sit in the silence, you know, and kind of confront and face things that the busyness and the over-connectedness and the overfull calendars can sometimes, you know, buffer us from thinking about.
I wonder what you say to people who say that they're failed meditators, who kind of freak out at the notion of spending time in silence. Is that what this is about?
Well, I always lean on the wisdom of a priest friend of ours that's down here in Baton Rouge, and he was the pastor of a parish that my husband and I were when we were newlyweds, and he always shared with us. Because I can remember telling him one time, you know, how do I pray? Like, I have a newborn now, and I'm working, and at the time I was getting my graduate degree. And he always said, pray as you can, not as you can't. And that, to me, I think we can sometimes beat ourselves up and that we're not doing it right. You know, we don't know how to pray, or we feel like we're not still enough or silent enough, or maybe we feel like we don't know how to do it. But the reality is God meets us as we are, you know? And so, yeah, there's going to be days that we can pray and have lengthy times of silence and solitude. But then some days and some seasons of life, what we may get is just moments of pause, turning our heart and mind to God throughout the day. And I think what Ignatius, his gift is he arms us. There's so much wisdom in Ignatian spirituality that helps us pray our lives, you know, and I think that's when his, like, prayer of the examen, you know, that's so often credited to St. Ignatius' founding, and I know that there's some talk of people before him using it, but that prayer of the examen and, you know, taking the last 24 hours of your life and praying it and bringing it before God is just as beautiful and profound of a prayer as sitting for an hour in silence, you know. And sometimes our life allows for one, and sometimes our life, you know, allows for the other.
And so when we think about that, the notion of prayer and the daily examen, I want to get into what the daily examen is. But because you mentioned that, I wanted to ask you, because so much of Ignatian spirituality centers around prayer, what does prayer mean to you? How do you define what prayer is?
Oh, that's such a good question. What is prayer? I mean, I think my first definition, if I was going to grab, would be that simple act of pausing and turning your mind and heart to God. You know, and so that type of prayer can happen throughout our entire day, you know, I mean, many, many different times we can stop and notice what's before us, you know, kind of how Jesus in, I think it's Matthew, says, you know, consider the sparrows, you know, and what is it that the sparrows have to teach us is his sermon he's talking about. But what is before us and what is God saying to us in that moment? You know, is there something God might be offering to us? But then we can also take that same notion of turning our mind and heart to God if we're sitting with scripture, you know, or maybe we're just sitting in silence and it's just a word we're holding. But I think prayer is just that way of us communicating with God and God communicating also with us.
And that kind of leads me to the daily examine, which is something that is a really important part of Ignatian spiritual practice. And you talk about it in the book as a way to sort of go back through your day. What's the point of that?
Gosh, the examine is one of my favorite prayer tools. Can I just say that?
Sure.
I learned the examine, like you mentioned, that I'm from Baton Rouge, and I learned the examine at a time of my life when it was right after Hurricane Katrina, and I'm sure many people remember, you know, what that just experience was like. But living it down here, and I was in Baton Rouge, and I had several family members in New Orleans, and I was working at the Diocese of Baton Rouge at the time, and it was a very just overwhelming time of seeing people's suffering, and really a moment where I was questioning, you know, where is God in all of this? You know, how could God let this happen? And a priest, Father Matlin, a Jesuit, taught all of us. There was a group of women, about 50 of us, taught us this prayer. And what was so profound for me about the examine back then, and it still is now, is how it really helps you see God in all things, you know, which can be such this cliche statement that gets attached with Ignatian spirituality. You know, somebody's like, well, what? Tell me about Ignatian spirituality. Somebody's probably going to say, oh, it's about finding God in all things. And the idea of the examine is just to pause and review, bring your last 24 hours before God and ask God to help you see where God has been present, maybe where we've struggled to name God's presence, you know, and what is that about? Does it have something to do with my choices, my actions, my inactions, or maybe an opportunity I could have said something and I didn't? But the examine just remains for me personally, and I've loved teaching this prayer to so many people because it's a prayer that we can do at any time. You know, we can be sitting in our car and we can take, you know, a few minutes and bring the last 24 hours before God and ask for God's guidance and help.
I'm speaking with Becky Eldridge. She's the author of a book called Busy Lives, Restless Soul, and we're talking about her book, which is about Ignatian spirituality. And, you know, Becky, when you say that the idea of seeing God in all things, I'm thinking about, you write about this in the book, being in Baton Rouge, and I wonder if you can sort of share your experience of how you were able to, you know, you talk about how difficult it was to go through Katrina, how your family members were directly impacted,
yes.
Your sister-in-law who was working in a hospital in New Orleans. How did you see God in something like Katrina?
Oh, I mean, it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it. But at the time, like when it was happening, it was just overwhelming to see the suffering. And I was working at the Diocese of Baton Rouge at the time, and Catholic Charities was right across the parking lot. And so, you know, the impact of Katrina was way beyond just the day that it happened in August, you know. And for 18 months, I watched people line up outside of our doors, you know, waiting for help. And I mean, Baton Rouge's population, like, doubled. I mean, we were just inundated with people and resources. And so it took me a really long time. I would say at first, I don't know if I could say I felt like I was seeing God in all things and seeing God in that. But then when I prayed the examine, and when Father Matt invited us, and I think he sensed that we as the women in that retreat house needed something to help process what we had all gone through.
Which wasn't silence,
and
I guess, at that point.
Which,
right?
We were in the silent. We were all supposed to be quiet, but everybody was talking, because I think it was just, that's what we needed, you know, is to share some of our stories and then also have the opportunity to say, hey, here's where we're struggling and here's where we're not. And when he taught that prayer, it was the first time I was able to kind of really say, oh my goodness, like God was profoundly present in the people who were doing the work, you know, who were getting on the boats and getting people out, you know, who were getting on people's roofs and pulling people off, you know, and the people that were opening up their homes and to strangers. I mean, just rank strangers they didn't know, and they would open up their house and they'd have them stay with them. And so it was this reminder that all these prayers, I think, that were being offered, you know, and cried out, and all the suffering that was being seen, that God was responding to those prayers through empowering and calling people to serve and to act. And when I finally got that, I mean, it was just the most freeing moment, and just, oh, like I felt like I could breathe and think, okay, well, we weren't abandoned, you know, at that time.
You know, and when you think about that, you think about, you were saying you were with all of these women. You write about this in the book, and I wanted to ask you, women, you say women ask you this all the time. How do you find the time to pray or to do all of this when you're a mom?
Yeah, it's a hard question, you know? and it's one I've lived and continue to live and learn into, because seasons of motherhood change, you know? And so right now, you know, I think women have this great gift, though, of being intentional about what matters. And I think that when I look at the beautiful women in my life, you know, friends, family, colleagues, you can give a woman a task that matters and they're going to get it done. And I think that it's that same intentionality that we can apply to our prayer lives, even as a mom, you know, even when we've got all these people that might need our attention and our care. And, you know, right now, like for me, my prayer time is I get up before my kids do, you know, and sometimes it's hard. And if my 10-year-old was on the phone, he'd tell you I hit snooze sometimes. But, you know, I think we can make time for prayer because it's making time for the relationship that matters the most in our life. And we can do that by honoring it on our calendar the way we would any appointment. So maybe that means we're getting up early, or maybe that means we're carving out a little time in the evening or in our day. And the other thing I tell moms all the time is to be kind of courageous in asking for the time from the rest of the family, you know, and saying, this is going to be my prayer time. And can you, you know, mom's going to go in here and please don't disturb me for a few minutes. Or, it really took some time for me to have the courage to ask my family for that, both to ask my husband, Chris, and my kids to say, okay, when I'm in there, can you not, you know, can you leave me be and let me have that time? And it really, getting that support from your family and the people or whoever's living in your home, I think is a valuable thing.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but that is a little bit of how Becky Eldridge, as she's talking about the book, very aptly named Busy Lives, Restless Souls. It's out now. Thanks so much for being with us, Becky. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you, Nyla. I so appreciate the invitation to be with you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Every Monday, we bring you the latest in Illinois state politics, and we're joined by two political reporters to help us understand the details of all the headlines and more. On the phone from Chicago is WBEZ political reporter Tony Arnold, and joining us from Springfield is WUIS reporter Brian Mackey. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm just sorry you couldn't find somebody else named Brian to be on the panel.
Exactly. We could have gone for the trifecta here this week. Brian, I'll start with you. Can you tell us anything more about the status of the so-called grand bargain? Any more discussion on that here in the past week?
Yeah, well, I think what we're continuing to see is Democratic anger. Last week, we had the repercussions of the week before, the governor having pulled Republican votes off of that final what was expected to be a final set of votes. So last week, the Senate Democrats decided to stage a bit of a dog and pony show. They had agency heads come before the various committees and ask them, okay, the governor is counting on making up more than $4 billion in his budget proposal from this grand bargain, and he pulled the votes off. So since we're not going to be able to do that now, why don't you guys suggest some cuts? Of course, the administration people were not willing to play along with that. They didn't really suggest any cuts, which enabled the Democrats to have a sort of week recapping news conference where they had one of those poster boards with a big zero on it, suggesting that that's all the cuts they were able to get from the administration. I don't know that it's necessarily completely dead, but the two sides seem to be a lot of mistrust, which is kind of the ongoing story of things here in Springfield.
Sure. Tony, anything to add on the grand bargain?
Well, what I'd say is there still seems to be some sort of disagreement over why this even fell apart. All last week, Governor Rauner, including on Friday, Governor Rauner denied any of the Democrats' allegations that it was he who pulled about seven Republican state senators off of the grand bargain. The way that those seven senators have been kind of identified is that, you know, there were a few, in a way, test votes on a few of the pieces of legislation of the grand bargain that were supposed to be less controversial, a little bit more universally accepted by both Democrats and Republicans. And initially, a few Republicans were saying no or present, voting present on some of those bills. Then when they were recalled a few weeks later by the Senate, then they were yes votes. And something changed then between one day and the next day, where then those senators were all saying, no deal, we're not going to do this. And Democrats were saying that those senators who were going along with it had been threatened by Governor Rauner. For his part, Rauner's saying there were no threats. He's saying that there's a lot of misinformation out there about why this fell apart. His point is that there just isn't a deal because the legislation is not there. It's not where he wants it to be, whether it's a permanent property tax freeze for municipalities all around the state, as opposed to a few years of a property tax freeze. That's the one that he points to often. So I think there's still some disagreement over just what stage this is even at in terms of what Rauner wants. Democrats are certainly feeling like they just feel like he doesn't even want a deal because he should have known that this is as good as it's going to be. But Republicans, you know, he's holding firm that the deal is just not there yet. The Democrats haven't moved far enough off of their platform yet.
And before we get too far into a he said, she said on this, though, I do think it's worth remembering that afternoon when the votes were not there, Democrats were saying, you know, we heard from Republicans that they were called in to talk to the governor. The administration did acknowledge sort of in its elliptical way that, yes, we constantly meet with Republicans, not at least outright denying that they were meeting with some of these legislators at that point. One day, as Tony said, the votes were there. The next day they weren't. I went to ask one of these legislators in his office after that evening, and I stood in the doorway, and I actually put this in my story. I knocked and said, hey, can I ask you about this? And, you know, the Democrats are saying the governor pulled you guys off. And he just sort of very coolly looked straight ahead and said, no comment. And that was that. So now we have the following week, the governor not really wanting to take the blame after a series of newspaper editorials and people are pointing the finger at him for having scuttled this deal. The Senate Democrats will say there's a reason we left the governor out. We also left the House Speaker out. This was supposed to be a Senate Republican, Senate Democratic negotiation. And, you know, with the governor getting involved, that's what they say scuttled the deal.
Interesting stuff, as always. Also last week, Governor Rauner accused Democrats, particularly House Speaker Mike Madigan, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and Controller Susana Mendoza, of conspiring to shut down the government. Tony, I'll start with you. What's going on here?
What's going on is that because we're at month 20 of the impasse, and as you just, as we're talking about, there's no legislative action, so there's almost exclusively court action. The reason the state government even exists right now is because judges have gotten involved saying, well, the state has to pay for certain things. Some of these lawsuits or different variations of them or different motions involving the same lawsuits keep coming up. And right now there's a few different moving pieces in court over everything that's going on. One of them is that Attorney General Lisa Madigan is asking the courts, she's now asking the Illinois Supreme Court to say that state employees should not be getting paid. And the reason for that is because lawmakers never passed a budget saying allowing the state to actually pay those salaries. Her logic is that if there's no employees showing up to work because they're not getting paid, then that would be a pretty good motivation to reach a budget agreement. So that's one issue of how the governor's saying, well, Attorney General Lisa Madigan wants to shut down the government. Another example is that where employees currently are getting paid from. There's many different funds in the state government where money is sourced and then sent from. The comptroller, if you don't know, is who's in charge of that, where those funds. And the governor saying that the comptroller is purposely depleting an emergency fund to create a crisis, I suppose, if there is an actual shutdown. The comptroller says, no, this isn't like an emergency fund. This is just normal processes. And also, there shouldn't be a government shutdown, so don't worry about that. So that's step two here of how there's a government, Mendoza and Madigan are plotting a shutdown. And then step three, then, is that Rauner saying, well, everybody knows that all Democrats only do what House Speaker Michael Madigan, who's the chairman of the state Democratic Party, they only do what Madigan tells them to do. So that's where you get this logic from the governor. Each one of them, I think, obviously deny this, that they're saying they're not trying to shut down the government. They're trying to, simply put, stop the impasse. And so that's where this is going on. There's this way that the governor talks about his political opponents, that this whole system in Illinois is corrupt or full of conflicts of interest or that kind of thing. And this, what he's doing here, saying that the Attorney General, the Comptroller, the House Speaker, they're all in on this, it kind of fits in with what he's been saying for the last several years. The difference now, though, is that he's the governor and not just a candidate for governor. And so that means that the governor himself is overseeing or a part of this whole system that he's raising issue with in a very serious way.
Sure. And Brian, has there been any proof offered of this so-called conspiracy?
None that I've seen, other than the fact that they're all Democrats and two of them happen to be a father-daughter relationship. But no documentation. And, of course, we heard from House Speaker Michael Madigan's spokesman, who called it, I think, the word delusional came up in his response. I think it's worth taking a step back, though, and saying that, why is there this maneuvering right now? Why is the governor making these points? The governor clearly does not want a state government shutdown in terms of the public perception of that. We've seen these play out in Washington, in Congress, in the mid-1990s, and then again just a few years ago. These do not generally work out well for the people who are perceived as prompting the shutdown. In Washington, you have the images that always stick in my head are the World War II veterans on the honor flight having to kind of scamper over the barricades to go visit the World War II memorial because the national park sites shut down. Well, we haven't had that sort of imagery in Illinois because the governor has seen to it that the schools open. The prisons have had food. He's scrimped and used bent coat hangers and scotch tape in some cases, but he has kept state government going in the absence of a budget for going on 20, 21 months now, which is pretty remarkable. But you know, another thing that's occurred to me this week is, you know, the governor says that the Democrats, Controller Mendoza, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and Speaker Madigan are trying to create a crisis. A lot of people would say Illinois government is already in crisis. If you work in the human service area, if you work with troubled teenagers or people with mental health problems or anything like that, and you've seen your funding dry up for the past 2 years, even though the state continues signing contracts with those groups, they would say government is already shut down. It is already in crisis. It's just a matter of how much that penetrates the public consciousness. And the polling we've seen shows that most Illinoisans, at least as of last fall is the last time I saw numbers on this, most Illinoisans do not think that the budget problems, the budget impasse in state government has affected them.
And Brian, we'll stick with you here for a moment. Something did get signed into law last week. It was a criminal justice reform bill that the governor signed on Friday. What's in this bill?
Yeah, these create, this is a sort of a good government criminal justice reform effort. The idea behind this is that many people who commit crimes actually start out as victims of crimes. And so in some neighborhoods, you have this cycle of trauma and retribution. So the idea in this bill is to address the role of trauma in criminal behavior. It's going to target what they call high-risk, underserved communities. You'll have people on the ground actually building relationships to help victims better deal with grief and anger. One of the lead sponsors of this is Representative Jahan Gordon Booth. She's a Democrat from Peoria. Back in 2014, her stepson was shot to death. And so she says in some communities, violent trauma is all too common. This is one of the few bright spots in Illinois government has been the way legislators have been able to work together to try and improve our criminal justice system. And this is something that that, as you said, did get signed into law.
And Tony, there was another bill being discussed in the Senate last week. I know that Chicago superintendent of police was involved in testifying on that bill that was discussed. What's the status there?
The status is that in the state house, stricter gun laws have been, or gun sentencing laws have been debated for a few years now, but not really gone anywhere for a variety of reasons. The main reason is that you have different factions all across Illinois that it all kind of opposes for different reasons. And this bill is kind of going through the same process, the same ringer. This bill, in short, is coming from the Chicago mayor, the Chicago superintendent of police, to try to address Chicago's gun violence problem. And the idea is that if you are convicted of illegally using a gun multiple times, then you're going to go to prison for longer. It's just that when they spell out what that is, on the ink and paper with legal terms, then it's like, well, you start seeing some different groups pulling off. Some people from Chicago said, well, this is going to be really hard on minority communities. Some people in the suburbs said that there's elements of this about being softer on people who use drugs, and so we don't like that part of it because heroin is a really big issue right now in Chicago suburbs. So there's just some different groups of people who are opposed to this thing, it passed by a very narrow margin out of committee, but we'll see how much farther it actually gets.
All right, very good. And before we say goodbye, Tony, I'll finally ask you, if you can, and maybe in about 30 seconds or so, tell us about the role that Chance the Rapper played in Illinois politics this week.
Well, Chance, in short, he had a meeting. What started with an innocuous tweet from the governor congratulating him on his Grammy wins turned into a meeting that Chance the Rapper said did not go well because he wants to see the state give more money to Chicago public schools. Obviously, that's all part of what's wrapped up in the budget impasse. And after a week-long kind of back and forth here, it kind of ended with Chance giving $1 million to Chicago public schools. And Rauner and kind of not really budging at all on his position about what needs to be done to get CPS its money. And honestly, after all this drama, not anywhere closer to a budget deal.
All right. WBEZ reporter Tony Arnold and WUIS State House reporter Brian Mackey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to our producers, Halda Dalahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Arar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Moldine, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo this week. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.